You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
With 11 weeks still remaining in the year, the number of bank failures for 2010 is fast approaching last year's total of 140. Three additional banks closed just this past Friday, bringing this year's total to 132. The numbers are quite alarming, but nothing compared to President Roosevelt's action in 1933, where he was forced to close every bank in the country. And that same year, Ferdinand Pecora took over the stock market hearings, which uncovered a secret financial history of scams, abuses, and fraud on Wall Street. Michael Perino's book, The Hellhound of Wall Street, How Ferdinand Pecora's Investigation of the Great Crash Forever Changed American Finance, tells that story. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Perino, who is the Dean George W. Matheson Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, Ferdinand Pecora, who was a former New York prosecutor, became a household name in 1933. How did a relative unknown come to lead the most important investigation into the Great Crash?
Almost by pure luck, quite frankly. The investigation had been going on for about a year. It actually had started under Herbert Hoover. He wasn't really interested in investigating Wall Street so much. He just wanted to he was confident that short sellers were impinging on his ability to get reelected by driving down prices on Wall Street, and he wanted to scare them a bit. So he started this Wall Street investigation, and for the first year or so, it basically accomplished nothing.
Well, the Congress was controlled, at least the Senate was controlled by the Republican Party.
It was controlled by the Republican Party, but there's this huge split in the Republican Party back then. There were a group of progressive Republicans, mostly from the Midwest, and the West, who actually were no big fans of Wall Street. And one of those, a man by the name of Peter Norbeck, a former artesian well driller from South Dakota, was the chairman of this banking committee. And he wanted to have a full-throated investigation of Wall Street. Unfortunately, nobody else did. It was after the election. Hoover, of course, had lost handily. We were waiting for Roosevelt to come in, which was back then March 4th, 1933. And it was the lame duck session of Congress. Nobody seemed much interested in reviving this investigation. Norbeck offered the committee counsel job to five different people. Five different people turned Norbeck down. And the last of them, former Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby, said, "I know this guy from New York, Ferdinand Pecora. He's the best cross-examiner in New York. You should hire him."
Well, I would imagine with the kind of anti-Italian sentiment that still was common in this country, that that wouldn't have been the most popular choice. This man was an immigrant from Sicily, although he came here when he was just 4 years old.
He came here when he was 4 years old, but he was very much a product of that anti-Italian, anti-immigrant sentiment. And it wasn't quite as virulent in 1933 as it was when Pecora came to this country in 1886, but it was definitely still there. Interestingly enough, about 2 weeks before this crucial time period that I talk about in the book, which we'll get to, there was an Italian immigrant bricklayer from named Giuseppe Zangara who made an assassination attempt on Franklin Roosevelt. And Time magazine wrote about Zangara. He basically said illiterate dagos always have, you know, we're not surprised by this reaction from these illiterate dagos who are, you know, violent and are disturbed when their creature comforts are bothered.
Did Pecora have to go through any process to be made the investigator here?
Absolutely not. It was the committee's choice to pick this guy. And what's interesting about it, though, is that everything that we think of as the Pecora hearings, this great investigation of Wall Street, almost never happened. Pecora was actually given a very small task when he took over the committee hearings. He was told, "We just want you to write a report of what we've done over the previous year," which was essentially nothing. Pecora was not short on ambition, and he somehow convinced Norbeck to let him take one more set of hearings. And yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And so the what he decided to do was to put on the stand one of the most prominent bankers of his day, Charles Mitchell, the head of the National City Bank, which we know today as Citigroup.
And he used all available resources, the sort of thing that a prosecutor would have done, subpoenas and the like. You mentioned that he was reputed to be one of the best cross-examiners of his day. He had an amazing memory, and he seemingly could recall at an instant every piece of testimony and every scrap of evidence you write, which must have come in very handy when he was addressing some of these bankers who gave all sorts of contradictory testimony during the hearings.
Well, and we see the same thing today, right? You know, when we see these hearings, we see people trying to give evasive answers, to try to not answer the question that they've been asked, or to give a self-serving sort of canned answer. It happens all the time. Pecora wouldn't stand for it. One of his nicknames at the time, the title for the book, The Hellhound of Wall Street, he was actually more of a pit bull than a hellhound. He wouldn't take an evasive answer, and he was the most prepared guy in the room.
On the other hand, you do say that he made certain missteps, but his success lay in his ability to crystallize the zeitgeist of the early Depression years into hard facts and concrete evidence. The mood of the country was, we want something to come out of this, something concrete to come out of this.
Pecora had his skills as a lawyer working to his advantage, but he also had a very receptive audience. There were few fans of Wall Street at the time, given all of the economic crisis in the country, 25% unemployment, the banks shutting left and right. There were few fans of Wall Street. But a lot of the anger at Wall Street wasn't really directed at men like Charles Mitchell, these elite leaders of the top financial institutions.
Paul Sunshine, Charlie Mitchell. He was the he was with Citibank, which is now spelt differently, but the same name.
It's basically the same bank. It's the successor bank now.
He also went after J.P. Morgan Jr.
Very famously went after J.P. Morgan Jr. After these committee hearings, the investigation was slated to end when Roosevelt came in on March 4th, and his success with Charles Mitchell allowed the investigation to be reauthorized. And he famously, at Roosevelt's direction, put the folks from J.P. Morgan on the stand in May of 1933.
And J.P. Morgan Jr. complained that Pecora treated him like a horse thief.
This was not the reception that J.P. Morgan was used to getting. He also complained privately that Pecora was a dirty little wop, quite frankly.
That probably ingratiated him to Mr. Pecora. There's a funny anecdote in the book about those hearings with J.P. Morgan Jr. that involved circus promoters and a midget.
It was one of the iconic images from those hearings. So let me give you a little bit of setup. Pecora was conducting these investigations. This hearing involving J.P. Morgan was the media sensation of the day. They brought in extra telegraph lines into the Capitol, into the Senate office building, so that they could get out, newspapermen could get out their stories. This was one of the big stories of the day. There was a senator named Carter Glass from Virginia, and several of
Glass-Steagall fame?
Of Glass-Steagall fame. And several of his former assistants when he was Treasury Secretary were partners at Morgan. And Carter Glass did not like political theater. He thought it was a Roman holiday, he said, and it took away from crafting the carefully crafted legislation that he wanted to craft. So he and Pecora butted heads because Pecora knew you needed a little bit of sensationalism to get people interested in what most people consider to be a dry topic. Well, one day in the hearing, Glass complained, yes, that's what we're having here. We're having a circus. All we need is colored lemonade and peanuts. Well, this caught the attention of a Ringling Brothers promoter. And the next day, while the committee was in an executive session, he brought into the hearing room Lia Graff, who was the Ringling Brothers circus midget. And he thought it would be wonderful to have the shortest woman in the world sit on the lap of the world's richest man.
So what happened to J.P. Morgan Jr. and to Charlie Mitchell? Were their careers hurt, damaged?
J.P. Morgan was very much near the end of his career, and there was not much evidence that his career was damaged at all by these hearings. As a matter
of fact, name is still on the company.
His name is still on the company. In terms of Charlie Mitchell, one of the things that Pecora uncovered during these hearings, one of the things that really captured public attention was the fact that during 1929, as the stock price of Citibank is plummeting to the floor, Charles Mitchell engaged in a wash sale with his wife. He sold her stock and then bought it right back after the first of the year in order to claim a loss on his income tax and not pay any tax that year. He was indicted for tax evasion shortly after the Pecora hearings. He was found not guilty. He went on to head another investment banking firm, and he retired a relatively rich, well-respected man on Wall Street.
My guest is Michael Perino, whose book, The Hellhound of Wall Street, How Ferdinand Pecora's Investigation of the Great Crash Forever Changed American Finance, is published by Penguin Press, and it's the picture on the cover of Pecora with a cigar in his mouth. You can't imagine anybody posing like that, anybody who's heading an investigation for Congress. You write that most Americans didn't understand how much bankers made. And by contrast, during this Great Recession, the press has been full of stories about the pay on Wall Street, which incidentally the Wall Street Journal reported last week was, quote, on pace to break a record high for a second consecutive year, with more than three dozen top banks and security firms paying $144 billion in salary and benefits. It doesn't have the same kind of impact today that it did in the past.
Well, I think it does have the same kind of impact to a certain degree. I think there is still populist outrage at the salaries on Wall Street. The difference is we know what those salaries are. And one of the reasons we know what those salaries are was that these Pecora hearings ushered in a whole new set of regulations. They ushered in the first federal securities laws, which require, among other things, disclosure of executive compensation. So the surprise factor isn't there anymore. I think the outrage factor still exists.
Well, there were attempts in Congress to curtail the bonuses of bankers, and that was a big story a few years back. Nothing's happened.
For Pecora,
in 1933, it would have happened, wouldn't it?
I don't think so. I don't think Pecora's aim was to curtail salaries. I think there were some people on the Senate committee, particularly this rabble-rousing senator from Iowa named Smith Wildman Brookhart. But Pecora wasn't after curtailing salaries. What Pecora was after was disclosure. He thought that, you know, and this is still the philosophy of the federal securities laws, what we need is not the government coming in and telling bankers you can't pay a salary over X amount of dollars. We need the government to come in and say, if you're going to pay these salaries, we want you to disclose ahead of time what everybody's getting paid. And that gives shareholders and everyone else information on which they can act.
But were the salaries as outrageous then as they are now proportionately?
Oh, absolutely. If you adjust for inflation, Charlie Mitchell was making in the 3 years before the 1929 stock market crash, he pulled in about $500 million just personally.
$500 million.
In today's dollars.
Yeah. Not
which
bad.
Is not bad. If you can get it.
I've been asking my boss to give me a raise. Michael Perino's book, The Hellhound of Wall Street, How Ferdinand Pecora's Investigation of the Great Crash Forever Changed American Finance, is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Michael Perino, who used to be a litigator on Wall Street, now is the Dean George W. Matheson Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law, and the author of The Hellhound of Wall Street, How Ferdinand Pecora's Investigation of the Great Crash Forever Changed American Finance, published by the Penguin Press. What got you thinking about writing about him?
I actually started writing a completely different book. which was tangentially related to these hearings. And I knew that Pecora had given this oral history to the Oral History Project up at Columbia University back in the 1960s. And I decided to go and sit down and read it. So I went up to the rare book room on the eighth floor of Butler Library, and they wheeled out a cart with 8 black three-ring binders on it, 1,600 pages of transcript. Pecora could talk up a storm. And I sat down, and by page 10, I was completely hooked on Pecora.
Didn't he also write a memoir?
He did write a memoir. He wrote a memoir in the late 1930s called Wall Street Under Oath, where he recounted more the findings of the hearings than the background of what was going on, the backstory of the hearings. So I wanted to do a little of the backstory and a little of Ferdinand's life.
And it is it's rumored that Phil Angelides, who has been has been heading a an independent panel, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, says that he keeps Pecora's memoirs near his bed, but he has not been as effective as Pecora.
There are, I think, a couple of reasons why. The first reason why is I think he's given a structure that is very difficult to work with. We're talking about an independent commission, not a hearing run by one man like the Pecora hearings were, but an independent commission with 10 commissioners appointed from various political perspectives and philosophical perspectives.
Do they cancel each other out?
They tend to. A lot of what you see in the reports of these kinds of commissions tend to be the products of consensus, and sometimes they can be watered down to almost nothing. In terms of Pecora's ability to go after the bankers on Wall Street, he was ready, willing, and able to issue subpoenas. He knew that banks are going to do what banks are always going to do. They delay. And without that subpoena, it was going to be hard to pry those documents
out.
Well,
how did he work within the political environment of the time? The Supreme Court was pretty much undermining every New Deal legislation that FDR came out with, although I guess that was a little later. But the country became polarized in much the same way that it's polarized today. I mean, and much of what he was doing could have been seen as being quite partisan.
And certainly in certain quarters in Lower Manhattan, it was viewed as quite partisan. As 33 changed over into 34, there was a strong lobbying campaign coming from the financial industry to try to hold back some of the reforms that Pecora was trying to put in place. But Pecora had strong political backing. He had Franklin Roosevelt, who wanted an investigation that would go after the bankers and reveal everything that was going wrong. What Roosevelt knew was that he needed to galvanize public opinion for reform. And in order to do that, he needed a little bit of sensationalism. He needed a little bit of disclosure of the wrongdoing that was going on in Washington. And once he had that anger, the usual political forces that tend to prevent this kind of reform legislation were swept aside.
Well, there was also a really serious crisis in 1933 when Roosevelt took office. You write, 38 states had closed their banks altogether, and everywhere else withdrawals were sharply curtailed. Thousands of banks failed each year, and 1 in 4 families lost all of their life savings.
It was an incredibly difficult time. And if you think about New York, I mean, there were 200 wood shacks behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There were people living below Riverside Drive in the dumps that used to line there. It was
25% unemployment.
25% unemployment. So it was the worst economic crisis of the time. And part of Pecora's success was, in an odd sense, his impeccable timing. If he hadn't come onto the stage at just that moment when we were in that crisis, he might not have succeeded the way he did.
How much credit does Pecora deserve for one of the most far-reaching pieces of legislation to come out of Roosevelt's administration, the Glass-Steagall Act?
Well, the Glass-Steagall Act, as many of your viewers probably know, is it did two things primarily. One, it created federal deposit insurance, probably the most important structural banking reform to come out of the New Deal legislation.
Is that one of the reasons this current recession has not been as disastrous as the Great Depression?
You opened up this segment by talking about bank failures on the order of 100 or so in the last year. Back in that time, we were talking about thousands of bank closures at the time. And part of the success of – or the part of the reason why we don't have that level of failure were the changes made by Glass-Steagall in putting in place deposit insurance. The other thing that Glass-Steagall did, which has since been repealed, is the separation between commercial and investment banking. And that flowed directly out of these hearings involving Citibank. I think Pecora, to answer your question, we owe him a huge debt of gratitude. Glass-Steagall actually was proposed in the weeks before Pecora became counsel and went down to a fiery defeat at the hands of Huey Long from Louisiana. Everybody in the banking industry hated it, from the folks who ran the small Midwestern banks to the folks who ran the big banks on Wall Street. Glass-Steagall was dead. But when Pecora came in and Pecora began his hearings and began to show the wrongdoing at Citibank and the wrongdoing at J.P. Morgan, the political tide changed completely.
But didn't it in the end help the banks because they became stable to the point where they felt they could get rid of Glass-Steagall again? And it is ironic that Glass-Steagall was repealed, at least in part, with the help of Citibank's efforts.
They were there at the beginning and they were there at the end. And yes, I suppose it is ironic. Certainly the deposit insurance piece of this was a reform that many people didn't want. Franklin Roosevelt didn't want deposit insurance. He thought it was going to cause the strong banks to prop up the weak ones. And it has proved to be even somebody like Milton Friedman says that deposit insurance was the best thing we did in the New Deal.
My guest is Michael Perino, who's written a book called The Hellhound of Wall Street: How Ferdinand Pecora's Investigation of the Great Crash Forever Changed American Finance. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you think that Pecora's unshakable belief in the rightness of his mission to uncover fraudulent behavior of bankers is what made that investigation so successful?
I certainly think it helped. Pecora wasn't a big fan of Wall Street, but he wasn't – I want to contrast what Pecora did from what we see sometimes in congressional hearings today. The ones I'm thinking about are the hearings a few years back involving AIG and the bonuses paid at AIG. And what we had there was a bunch of congressmen getting up and sort of expressing righteous indignation that AIG could pay out these bonuses. There was no new information. There was nothing there that we hadn't already heard in the press. It was just the chance to show outrage. I think that kind of hearing isn't very effective if you're trying to get change. What Pecora did was Pecora actually thought a congressional investigation should involve investigation, and he dug for facts that people didn't already know.
To some degree, he was doing what Elliot Spitzer felt it was necessary for him to do when he was New York State's Attorney General.
Definitely some parallels there.
Well, the FCIC's investigation, although the FCIC's website makes it plain that they're a bipartisan commission with no real axe to grind, in a recent article on the hearings held in Florida by the FCIC, it seems clear that they are uncovering some important information. Quote, Florida led the nation in mortgage fraud, and this fraud is responsible for untold trillions of dollars in bad loans currently defaulting across the country. So why do I still feel that this group is so toothless?
I think there's a reason for that. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, I think the disclosures coming out of the FCIC, there has been some new information, but it has been variations on motifs that we've already seen in the financial press. They haven't really uncovered anything startlingly new. So I think that's one thing. Second, I think it's in the way they present the information. The most telling moment for me was during the hearings involving Goldman Sachs, which were about derivative securities. And the vice chairman of the commission, Bill Thomas, said, I don't want to get lost in any of these intriguing stories. Pecora wanted to get lost in the intriguing stories. He knew the intriguing stories were the way that he could explain to the American public something that was complex. So he used them as tools for making a point. And I think that is one of the failings that the FCIC has had.
One of the significant laws that was passed after the hearings was a security law that was intended to hold sellers of securities accountable. The buyer of any security was to be told about all the risks. When did that stop happening?
Well, it wasn't supposed to. It's funny. I started this book in the summer of 2008, about a month and a half before the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And, I would sit and read these transcripts from 75 years ago all day, and then I would come home and I would watch the news. And it was the same story in both places. One of the things the FCIC just uncovered was about the due diligence that was done on these pools of mortgages. And basically they had information that said that the many of these mortgages didn't meet underwriting standards at the banks.
There were shady home appraisals.
And they didn't disclose it to the investors who bought in the mortgage pools. Well, you go back to the 1920s, and it wasn't collateralized mortgage obligations back then. It was the debts of foreign governments like Peru and Brazil. And the Citibank officials had documents that said, Peru's treasury was flat on its back and gasping for breath. And not a word of that was disclosed to investors.
Well, here we have these recent hearings that are focusing on liar's loans, predatory mortgage practices, shady home appraisals. And the conclusion is that the financial impact of the fraud was more severe than most people have estimated. But then they also say prosecuting those responsible will be nearly impossible. That's no different. You point out that Charlie Mitchell and J.P. Morgan Jr. both died rich men.
They did. And we have to make a little bit of a distinction here. I'm going to turn on my law professor mode for a second. A lot of what you're talking about in terms of the underlying mortgages are aspects that aren't governed by these laws that Pecora put in place, aren't governed by the federal securities laws and Glass-Steagall and those kinds of provisions. You raise a fair point about, have we really changed anything as a result of these laws? And one of the things I'd point to, quite frankly, is something that Pecora himself said in his memoirs in 1939. What prompted him to write those memoirs were that people were forgetting, even in 1939, some of the lessons of these laws. And he said the laws aren't a panacea, and they're not self-executing.
But fraud has always been against the law, and the commission believes, after expert testimony, that up to 70% of the mortgages now in foreclosure were the result of at least one element of fraud.
Right, and as I was trying to suggest earlier, it's not the job of the federal securities laws to be going after that stuff. If we're talking about fraud, we're going after it under various state laws that would be in place already.
And that's not happening.
It doesn't appear to be.
Well, if Pecora were around today, what do you think he'd be saying?
What Pecora would be saying is, wow, this looks familiar. I think what he'd say is the same thing he said to Franklin Roosevelt when Franklin Roosevelt signed what's called the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, the act that, among other things, created the SEC. And Roosevelt asked him whether it was good law or not. And Pecora said, it's going to depend on the men who administer it. We see the same thing with Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill that was passed earlier this year, leaves a lot of questions open. The SEC alone has 95 regulations to write under Dodd-Frank. It has to conduct 17 separate studies. What financial reform is ultimately going to be is going to depend on the men and women who are administrating that law. And what we need to see going forward is how rigorous they're going to be in putting in place those regulations. And that is, I think, something the FCIC can help out on.
Why do you think this hasn't been an issue during these midterm elections? Instead, we're talking about a whole bunch of other finance-related matters, but from a very different angle.
you know, we are. We're talking about bailouts. We're talking about TARP. We're not really talking so much about financial reform itself. And perhaps the reason is that, you know, anger at Wall Street seems to cut across party lines. Everybody seems to be angry at Wall Street. And so there's not much of a political issue to be made there.
Well, there are some people in Congress or running for Congress who think that Wall Street is getting a raw deal.
True enough.
And we've had a congressman apologize to BP for being picked on. So it's a little more complicated than that. He's not being drummed out of office.
No, he's not. I can't answer the question why it's not.
I'm just wondering whether it isn't that Ferdinand Pecora laid out the problems in a way that everybody could understand then. And we're not seeing the same sort of thing happening today.
You know, as I said earlier, I think that is a big issue here. One of, you know, Pecora's success was his ability to turn these complex economic problems into these very simple morality tales. And we haven't had anybody step forward and be able to crystallize it in quite that way.
Michael Perino is the Dean George W. Matheson Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law. His book, The Hellhound of Wall Street, How Ferdinand Pecora's Investigation of the Great Crash Forever Changed American Finance, although perhaps a few changes might still be – more changes might be appreciated.
Well, you know, the change the subtitle refers to is that prior to Pecora coming on the stage, the federal government had not one law that regulated what happened on Wall Street, and that's the significant change.
The book is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.